Headlines this hour. Iran says a Western-sponsored resolution submitted to the IAEA Board of Governors is unacceptable and meant to exert political pressure. Britain unveils an austerity budget with $65 billion of tax hikes and spending cuts while declaring its economy has plunged into a recession. Lebanon's parliament fails to choose a new president for the sixth time, raising concerns that the current economic crisis could worsen. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The IAEA's Board of Governors has reportedly passed a Western-sponsored resolution which calls on Iran to, quote, fully cooperate with the UN nuclear agency. The motion was brought by the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany. China and Russia voted against it. The resolution is associated with an IAEA probe into what it terms the presence of, quote, uranium traces at three undeclared sites in Iran. Earlier, Iran censored the resolution as unacceptable and politically motivated and warned of a firm response if it was approved. Iran says it has fully cooperated with IAEA in resolving the outstanding issues. Tehran says allegations about undeclared nuclear sites are based on fabricated information provided to the agency by the Israeli regime. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Investigations point to Ukraine's involvement in Tuesday's missile explosion on Poland's soil, but Washington and Kiev insist Moscow is to blame for the deadly incident. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Russia is ultimately responsible, regardless of the probe's final conclusion. Blinken says that Moscow is, quote, raining missiles down on Ukraine and seeks to destroy the country's critical infrastructure. Blinken says Ukraine has the right to defend itself and Washington stands by the government in Kiev. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has also blamed Moscow for the missile incident. Zelensky says he is confident it was a Russian missile. Western officials admit, in principle, the blast in Poland was likely caused by a Ukrainian missile. However, the UN Security Council became the scene of diplomatic spats over the incident.
At the same time, it is clear that the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine with regular missile terror as one of its core elements remains the only root cause of violence and human suffering in Ukraine and beyond. As soon as Russia is unable to continue its war, security in the region will immediately be restored.
These are statements made by a man who cannot fail to have access to information that it was Ukrainian missiles that crossed into Polish territory launched by Ukrainian air defense systems. That means that this is not just an intentional attempt to disinformation, but a conscious attempt to involve NATO, which is conducting a proxy war with Russia and Ukraine, to involve it into direct conflict with our country.
The Polish ambassador to the UN also took a jab at Russia, saying that the incidents would not have happened if there were no Russian war against Ukraine. His remarks came despite the fact that Poland has acknowledged the missile was fired by Ukrainian forces. NATO and the U.S. have backed Warsaw's assessment. Two people were killed after the missile hit a Polish village near the border with Ukraine on Tuesday. Johnny Miller is our correspondent joining us from Donetsk. We also have Gilbert Doctorow, who's an independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. So, Johnny Miller, first over to you. Obviously, this was something that needed the UN Security Council's attention. But at this point, how do things stand?
Well, originally, Ukraine and NATO officials, also one unnamed source in the American intelligence community, blamed Russia for this strike on Poland. But now it seems very clear and admitted, at least by NATO, that it was a Ukrainian missile that hit Poland. Interestingly, we're seeing here now the largest divide that we've seen yet between NATO and Ukraine. I'll read a quote here from the Financial Times, a journalist there, who says that in Kiev, a NATO a diplomat said to him, "This is getting ridiculous. The Ukrainians are destroying our confidence in them. Nobody is blaming Ukraine, and they are openly lying. This is more destructive than the missile, because the Ukrainians are still saying that it was a Russian missile, whereas NATO are admitting that it wasn't." There has been some backtracking on that today from Zelensky. But why this is very dangerous, and indeed many of the front pages of Western newspapers originally ran with the headline that Russia had attacked Poland. This, of course, could operate the Article 5 of NATO's treatment treaty, basically potentially starting a war between Russia and NATO, potentially a nuclear war. But of course, that story turned out to be fake. So now Ukraine is slowly backtracking from that. There's also been a major loss of credibility from certain Western newspapers who have been reporting that these were Russian missiles, but actually it turns out now they were Ukrainian. But it also brings into focus the threat of a miscalculation here or a mistake that could bring Russia and NATO into war together.
Indeed. So you have the miscalculation threat on the one hand, Gilbert Doctorow. On the other hand, I'm curious as to whether two things could have happened here to have triggered the Article 5 and whether we would have seen a response. First of all, they could have said, no, this was a Russian missile, because we know that they lie. And they could have gone ahead with it. And I'm asking you whether that would have been a possibility. On the other hand, what if it was a Russian missile or two that landed in Poland? Do you think that NATO would have that Article 5 triggered, and would a war have erupted between NATO and Russia?
Yeah, that's quite a question. This event was extremely interesting. If we can step back a minute from the threat to our existence that was implicit in what the Kievan regime was saying, the intent on the part of Mr. Zelensky was clearly to push Poland and the United States, NATO, into a more active support, if not invoking Article 5, then at least Article 4, and preparing the way for what would be a hot war between NATO and Russia. The Russians immediately after the event called this a provocation on the part of Mr. Zelensky and the Ukrainians, and that has not been explored fully for reasons that would be very embarrassing for the U.S. side. Provocation because if this were indeed an air defense missile, it should have been fired to the east and to the north from where Russian incoming cruise missiles would be coming. Instead, it was fired due west. So if you want to say that this was erring on the path, then you're being very, very kind to the Ukrainians. It was a provocation. It was intended to prompt the Poles and the United States ultimately into a hot war with Russia. And it failed. It failed in a way that similar potential false flag operations did not see. If you go back several years, if you go back to the event that was quite important today in Europe, the decision on the MH17 crash, that was a false flag event. And we know that because then minutes after the crash, John Kerry was out there saying that the American intelligence showed that the Russians did it. It was possible to have a false flag and to blame the Russians immediately without any investigation because the objective was rather limited. It was to push Europe towards draconian sanctions on Russia. What happened now is a different situation. It's a proxy war between Russia and NATO, and the United States in particular does not in any way want an event to occur that would prompt a hot war. So it was precisely the Americans who in the past were stage managers of false flag events, both in the one I mentioned, MH17, also the false flag events in Syria with regard to the alleged allegations of chemical weapons being used against civilian populations. These were stage managed from Washington, and Washington completely supported all the allegations made on the spot. In this case, Washington was not the inventor of it, was not the author of it. It was Mr. Zelensky's team that hoped to draw NATO and the United States into a war. And this was immediately disavowed by Washington. That's very interesting. It shows that when Washington faces the possibility of a hot war, and maybe even nuclear war, the cowardly face comes out. And it's something I expect the Russians have taken note of.
Okay. That does it for the wrap-up of this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Britain has unveiled an austerity budget of $65 billion worth of tax hikes and spending cuts to rein in soaring prices and inflation.
Today's statement delivers a consolidation of £55 billion and means inflation and interest rates end up significantly lower. We achieve this, Mr. Speaker, in a balanced way. In the short term, as growth slows and unemployment rises, we will use fiscal policy to support the economy. From April, we'll
continue the energy. Some measures include a windfall tax increase for oil and gas firms and an extension to a freeze in the income tax threshold. Britain is embroiled in a cost of living crisis where the public has to pay higher taxes and reduce spending. The British finance minister says the austerity measures are required to bring financial stability as the country goes through a recession. The Central Bank of England blames Brexit for the UK's economic woes. The government, however, insists that the war in Ukraine and the COVID pandemic are the main culprits in the economic downturn. The annual inflation in Britain now stands at its highest level in over 40 years. The French President Emmanuel Macron says an offer to build submarines for Australia is still on the table. Macron was speaking in Bangkok one day after meeting the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Indonesia. He said the French deal was meant to protect Australia's sovereignty by helping it build an in-house submarine fleet instead of a deal which does not allow them to produce and to maintain in-house. Macron also explained that the French submarine deal was not about confronting China.
We were helping and accompanying Australia in building a submarine fleet in-house, an industrial cooperation. So it was both industrial cooperation and giving sovereignty to Australia, because they will maintain the submarines themselves. And it is not confrontational to China, because they are not nuclear-powered submarines.
Macron said that there had been no indication yet from Canberra to his proposal. Last year, Australia's former government canceled a multi-billion-dollar order for submarines with the French military. It opted instead for a deal with the U.S. and Britain. The move, which Paris called a stab in the back, sparked outrage in France. Lebanon's parliament fails to choose a new president for the sixth time, raising fears that the current economic crisis may worsen. In a vote held on Thursday, presidential candidates fell short of acquiring the minimum 86 ballots needed to be elected. That after nearly half of the lawmakers left their votes blank. A member of parliament said, given the current deadlock, it is impossible to have a new president before 2023. Power vacuum could deepen the political crisis in Lebanon, which is already governed by a caretaker cabinet. The country is grappling with various economic and financial issues. The former President Michel Aoun, whose term ended last month, also took power in 2016 after a two-year vacancy at the presidential palace. From Lebanon to the U.S., where Republicans have taken control of the House of Representatives with a slim majority, far smaller than what the party was banking on. Winning with a margin of 218 seats in the 435-member House, Republicans now secure a legislative base to oppose President Joe Biden's agenda for the final 2 years of his term. Biden congratulated his Republican opponents on the win, saying that he is willing to work with them and serve the American people. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said that Americans are ready for a new direction and Republicans are ready to deliver. On Saturday, Democrats retained control of the Senate by winning 50 seats, plus Vice President Kamala Harris' tie-breaking vote. Now a consequential floor vote is set to take place on January the 3rd, when the newly elected members will choose their speakers, the third most important U.S. political position after President and Vice President. The Taliban have imposed further restrictions on women in Afghanistan, banning them from funfairs and gyms across the country. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
The Taliban's Ministry of Vice and Virtue have banned Afghan women from visiting all parks, using gyms and public baths. The ministry's spokesman tells Press TV the ban is being introduced because Islamic laws had not been followed.
Recently, women are banned from going to parks, sports clubs, and public baths by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. For the past 15 months, the orders given to these places were violated and ignored. That's why now it is decided that they should be banned. It is not clear how long the restrictions would last or whether they are going to be lifted.
The famous city park in Kabul, once filled with families' joy and laughter, now has turned idle and silent, with only a handful of men wandering through the complex. The ban order has also affected the livelihoods of people who have been making ends meet by working at public places.
They are interrupting our livelihoods with their decisions. Now they have banned women, so less customers are visiting here. Look, it's in the middle of the day, but no visitors. I have rented a photography shop here, and I used to have an adequate income. But now the ban is making me close it down.
Women rights activists urge the Taliban to reverse its course on all women's rights, saying such decisions would provoke national outrage.
Instead of attempting to ban the doors of parks for women, the Taliban should manage to let Afghan boys and girls learn. They should address the economic and humanitarian crisis in the country rather than focusing on weird restrictions on women. I'm sure such decisions expose the reality of the Taliban and would face public anger.
The Taliban have already banned women from traveling without a male relative. Secondary schools for girls have also been shut for over a year across the country. Afghan women are worried about being barred from public places after the authorities announced the new restrictions. The women are now calling for justice, demanding the authorities protect their rights. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The notorious Guantanamo Bay prison is a stain on the human rights record of the U.S. 20 years on, and this prison still stands as the symbol of the most disgraceful human rights abuses in the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, on January 11, 2002, the U.S. military began detailing captives of its global so-called war on terror at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, starting one of the longest and darkest chapters of its abusive treatment of suspects. In the years to come, hundreds of foreign Muslim men and even boys would be secretly detained, denied due process, and subjected to physical and psychological abuses, some of which amount to torture. According to New York Times, as of July 2022, the U.S. has imprisoned 780 men and boys at Guantanamo since 9/11, many of whom were later determined to have little or no connection with Al-Qaeda. Nine have died at the facility. Although President Obama ordered its close within 1 year in 2009, 36 remain detained. Since the beginning, Guantanamo has been an arrangement that aims to circumvent both domestic and international legal supervision. To start with, a detention site located at a U.S. Navy base on foreign soil provides the convenience of complete U.S. jurisdiction and control while avoiding the unpleasantness of any domestic legal oversight. Back then, the Bush administration labeled detainees there as unlawful combatants, a newly coined term, rather than the traditional prisoners of war. This labeling tactic gives the U.S. discretion to decide how these detainees would be treated. Because the U.S., one of the 196 states that have ratified the Geneva Conventions of 1949, is bound to guarantee POWs a minimum standard of care, including safe accommodation, adequate food and medical attention, as well as immediate release and repatriation after the cessation of active hostilities. States are required by these conventions to offer the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, access to detainees and prohibited from exposing POWs to violence, torture, or cruel treatment. Unlawful combatants, a term undefined in the Geneva Conventions or any other treaties, are therefore not guaranteed the above-mentioned legal protection. With the authorization of the U.S. administration and the military, the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, later created and subjected numerous detainees to the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, such as beating, sleep and food deprivation, extreme noise, isolation, severe cold, sexual humiliation, stress position, mock drowning, waterboarding, and walling. For over two decades, Guantanamo Bay has been at the center of controversy. It stands as a haunting moment of human rights violations by the U.S. on the grounds of national security. Through Guantanamo, the U.S. suggests to the world that it is acceptable to sideline human rights and humane treatment of detainees in the name of countering terrorism. More than two decades on, many in the U.S. still know little of the details of the systematic abuses carried out by the CIA and U.S. military against these foreign people for reasons. To start off, successive U.S. administrations have connived at these wrongdoings and chosen to cover up this moral low ground in its so-called war on terror. Only people cleared by the Pentagon can fly to the heavily guarded base. Proceedings from Guantanamo's military commissions, a flawed system, to persecute prisoners at the base have never been publicly broadcast. And transparency requests from media and activist groups have been resisted on the grounds that non-public information is classified. The Bush administration tried to block federal courts from reviewing Guantanamo cases. In the face of mounting domestic pressure, the Obama administration reviewed the legal status of each detainee but concluded that the detainees could continue to be held under the laws of war and not treated as POWs. In 2014, the Senate Intelligence Committee only released a heavily redacted summary of its 2014 report on the CIA torture program. The current administration has no intention to release the full Senate report, much less criminally investigate those responsible for creating, authorizing, or implementing the CIA's secret detention and torture program. Like the previous ones, it also opposes allowing the International Criminal Court to include abuses by U.S. nationals in its investigation on grave human rights crimes in Afghanistan. Besides, popular culture in the U.S. has often soft-pedaled and glorified the cruelty and failure of these measures. For example, the 2012 Hollywood blockbuster movie Zero Dark Thirty and the 2019 interrogation exhibit at the International Spy Museum in Washington trivialized the abuses inflicted on suspects and went so far as to suggest erroneously that torture worked. Guantanamo is hardly the only scourge from the U.S. so-called War on Terror. Its counterterrorism campaign has spread to 85 countries with scant transparency or oversight. Brown University's Cost of War project found out that with the participation of U.S. allies, the CIA secretly and extrajudicially transferred at least 119 foreign Muslims from one foreign country to another for incommunicado detention and harsh interrogation to various CIA black sites. The U.S. military also held thousands of foreign Muslim security detainees and POWs, including women and boys, at its detention centers abroad, including Abu Ghraib in Iraq and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, subjected many to physical and psychological abuse, and denied them access to lawyers and right to challenge the basis for their imprisonment. Despite the controversy, the U.S. has continued its cruel and inhumane practices against terrorism suspects to this day, transferring them to U.S.-run sites overseas where they are subject to torture. It is deeply disheartening to see a country that has been so central to the drafting of core international human rights instruments breaking its commitments. Before Guantanamo turns 21, bold steps need to be taken to reverse the course. Truth needs to be told. Justice needs to be upheld. Wrongs need to be made right. Those responsible for terrorist attacks must be held accountable to law and serve their terms properly to atone for their crimes. So are those who have incarcerated, tortured, and killed innocent men and women, boys and girls, in the name of countering terrorism. Also, New York Times wrote, at millions per detainee, Guantanamo prison stuck in a cycle of costly delays. More than 20 years have passed since the George W. Bush administration brought the first detainees to this remote outpost in southeast Cuba 4 months after the attacks of September 11, 2001. It was a makeshift temporary mission and it is still being run that way. expeditionary style, as the military calls it. Over the years, the Guantanamo prison has cost $7 billion and has housed 780 detainees and tens of thousands of troops on mostly year-long or shorter tours of duty. Even now, with just 36 detainees at the prison, each costs $13 million a year. When a brigadier general from the Michigan National Guards becomes the 21st commander later this year, he will inherit many of the same challenges as those who commanded before him. Moldy, unsafe buildings, an outsized prison staff, and ailing, aging detainees, some still suffering the consequences of torture in CIA prisons 2 decades ago.
Hidden Files.
One 100 years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in this show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years, and now Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists. They're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran, 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing, you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S., to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s. On a host of different nations, like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions, and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He's been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Welcome to the program, Mr. de Zayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s, and the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impacts of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I make in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice. Because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
Well, what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that, that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred DeZayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive, and for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging, and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us right here next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.